Hello and welcome to the Rogue Monkey Podcast. We are well into our 11th season now of sharing stories from around the world to help you on your journeys. This week we're heading into the performing arts space with actor, voiceover artist, trainer and coach Alistair Craig joining us. From appearing in West End shows to The Crown, from commercials to audiobooks, Alistair's skill set is far-reaching. But how do you get into that industry? And how do you sustain a job that is so changeable? What have been the lessons along the way? That is what we are about to find out, so we're going to get straight into it. Episode 83 of the Rogue Monkey Podcast, featuring actor Alistair Craig. Hello, Alistair, and welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Well, Kevin, good morning. It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm conscious that we've been trying to make this work for months and months and months. And it feels like we've been, do you remember when they were building the Channel Tunnel? And they were burrowing in from France and burrowing in from Britain. And it's taken us a while to get through our underground tunnels to meet each other. So it's good to be here. Thank you.
Well, they say the best things in life are worth waiting for. So we hope today's conversation lives up to those vast expectations. But do you want to give our listeners and viewers out there just a quick introduction to who you are, what you do, and a little bit of a headline of your story?
Yeah, okay. I suppose I'll begin with a collection of job titles. My craft is an actor. So I'm an actor and a voiceover artist. But I'm also, and at this point in my life, as importantly, a trainer and a coach. And I can talk to you a little bit more about what I mean by those terms as we go on. And just before you pressed go on our record just now on this podcast, I mentioned briefly purpose, and I've been thinking a lot in the last few years about purpose and trying to align purpose with everything that I do. And I think my purpose is around communication. So it's nothing particularly dramatic or impressive, but I think that is my purpose. I think I am fascinated with what makes good communication. How do we communicate well? What does it look like? What are the techniques and what are the actions that we take to make that happen? Obviously, as an actor, that's particularly freighted because our capacity to communicate really determines how well we can tell the stories that we're given. And in the work that I've created for myself and found beyond my career as an actor, really all I've done is just transfer that same question about how can we better communicate and then take that into other areas of work.
Well, there's plenty of rabbit holes for me to dive into there, but I think there's a few words that jump out for me immediately. You talked about communication, you talked about purpose. And interesting, you mentioned the coaching, which I think we'll dive into straight away, because one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing, I guess, away from my various roles is coaching. And I do feel that if you refine the definition of coaching down to its absolute fundamentals, it's the ability to communicate with another human being and tell a story well to inspire action. And I think that's a really interesting space, both with your acting hat on in the sense of portraying to your audience an incredible story, but also with your coaching hat on. So let's talk a little bit about that coaching kind of space and for you, what that means to you.
Well, it's an amazing intuition you've got there, Kevin, because it's a good place to start, because really it's starting from now and working backwards. So we're sort of reverse engineering this project. I became aware of coaching, and I'll define the terms as I understand it, which aligns pretty closely with what you just described. I became aware of coaching 5-6 years ago, and I spoke to one or two people who had done a coaching course. Two people I knew locally, actually, who had nothing to do with my background as an actor. They work in completely different fields, but they had become coaches. And I became really interested in this. And I did a coaching course with an organization called the Mo Foundation. And it's a wonderful organization. They are a not-for-profit, and really their purpose is to bring coaching to as many people as possible. So they train coaches, and then they try and invite the coaches that they've trained to come back into the organization, to give back, to volunteer work and what have you. And I sometimes do some training work for them now, delivering the very course that I went that I took 4 years ago. So I became aware of coaching, and what intrigues me about coaching in particular is that your coachee, the person you're coaching, has all the answers. And this is quite a contrast with training. And when I talk about training and the difference between training and coaching, for me, training, if you boil it down to its absolute crystal, is effectively telling, demonstrating, and getting people to then do that back and show each other and practice. Coaching, what I love about coaching, which you just alluded to just now, is that really it's just a way of questioning an individual so that they can realize what their goals are and what steps they're going to have to take to reach those goals. And I think one of the most valuable things about coaching, which I found enormously empowering being coached, is being held to account. And having a dedicated time with somebody to talk about what you really want to achieve, and how you're going to go about achieving that. And then coming back to that person sometime later, a week, 2 weeks, and then saying, okay, so how's that going? And that, I think, is an enormously powerful process. And in a way, its simplicity somewhat undersells its value, because it sounds, well, so what? Anyone can do that, right? I don't need to pay a coach to sit me down and have that conversation. But it's very, very hard to dedicate the purity and the lack of noise in that space. So it's very hard to create a time in your life when you can reduce the noise of life and just focus on your goals and targets. I think we find it very hard to give ourselves that space as people. I mean, not least because, you know, bloody busy. We're just doing life, right? Trying to exist. But I think giving oneself that time can be enormously valuable. And it's no coincidence that, you know, as soon as you start working with people in, I don't know, senior leadership roles in business, they've all got coaches and they've all been doing coaching because they recognize to function at a really high level, i.e. under lots of pressure with a lot of responsibility, you need support. And what's wonderful about a really good coach is actually you're giving support yourself in a space held by this other individual. So yeah, I would probably describe my coaching practice as really the most fledgling part of my the various different things that I do in life. And I do coach, and I coach people most weeks, but it forms a relatively small quantity of the overall volume of work that I do. And I think probably where I'm getting to with coaching, and where I think I'm going to wind up eventually, is having integrated coaching practice into the training work that I do. I don't think I will ever be somebody who says, I'm an executive coach, I also happen to be an actor and a voiceover artist, blah, blah, blah. I think for me, it fits best with me and my sense of self and my purpose being incorporated into the training work that I do, and having coaches practice within that to empower the people that I'm training.
It's funny you mentioned that, because I've been kind of slowly moving into the world of kind of coaching beyond the world of sport, kind of been doing some informal business stuff now for a few years. And when I first spoke to kind of a senior leadership coach about making that transition and said about going off on tangents, if you like, and doing things in another realm, they said, you're already doing it. Like, you just need to effectively formalize it and put the right label on it, but you're actually already doing most of these things. And I think I'm curious from your point of view is, yes, you've gone into this coaching space from a more formal point of view, but I would imagine, given the kind of personality that you have, going back 10 years, when you're in conversations with friends, family, other actors, whoever it is, you're informally providing that kind of coaching and mentoring support without even thinking about it. Just no one labeled it like that.
Well, that's really interesting, actually. Funny enough, I'm not sure I'd thought about that before. I mean, I had thought about, obviously, what transferable soft skills that I might bring as an actor to it. They say, and I'm sure if you've had actors on here before, they may have said this, acting is reacting. It's a really cheesy cliche, but it's true. Acting is reacting. And what it means is that really most of the time when you're acting, it's about the quality of your listening. And your listening and your engagement with the other person and how you respond to them. That really informs most of what an actor does. If an actor is spending most of their time in their own headspace, thinking about, what's my response to what that person's just said? You know, what do I think about that? They're probably not in the perfect space for acting. When our attention is mostly occupied with the other person and listening to them very, very carefully, then you have intuitive responses to that. And you just respond as we do in normal life without a huge amount of consideration about what that response is. So that's a long-winded intro to your question. Yes, I'm going to have to be honest with you here. I think coaching taught me one enormously valuable lesson. And I think it's a lesson that a lot of people probably learn. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say maybe this is a lesson that's one that's particularly valuable for quite a lot of men, certainly for men of my generation. I wasn't a good listener. I think I was a good actor, or a good enough actor at times. But that was very much a compartmentalized skill set. I don't necessarily think it ever occurred to me, or I ever had the impulse to bring that listening quality that you have on stage and on screen into my everyday life and to really listen to people. And one of the wonderful things about coaching is it's taught me to listen much, much better. And I mean, really, it's a journey. I mean, because I still over-talk and listening is still a challenge for me. I have to keep reminding myself to be a good listener in conversations, particularly in social situations. But yeah, I think listening is everything in coaching. And I think if you're somebody like you, where your job is to listen and question, I mean, you know, what you're doing in a podcast are some of the, you know, it's pretty meta for a coach to be doing podcasting at the same time because it employs so many of the same skills.
It's funny because I think it's been a personal and, I guess, professional journey from a listening point of view for me. And I think if I go back 3 years, and my wife will happily attest, I might look and engage, but I don't properly listen. And the more I've delved into that space, the more I realize that actually, if you think, especially if you do read into like the science of listening, if you like, which is kind of one of the things I've spent a bit of time doing, is actually you realize the thought processes you have when someone's talking. So, and I go back to my first podcast I did 2.5-3 years ago, and actually I was doing exactly the wrong things. Someone's talking and I'm going, yep, that's really interesting, but my head's already on the next question. I'm not listening to what you're saying. I'm getting excited to tell you what I'm about to tell you, not listening to what you're actually saying. And true listening, I think, when you talk about coaching connections with people, that's where I think that comes from, because very few people give you their full attention because they're driving or they're on the phone or they're eating dinner or they're doing whatever it is. And actually to have somebody who's completely 100% present, like truly present and listening to you as a person, I think that speaks to like something really deep within us that we actually just want to be heard, but not heard in a, oh, no, yeah, well done, I like that kind of way, but actually are genuinely listened to. And again, I'd be curious as to how far back some of that has gone, because earlier on in our professional careers, you know, we're the young upstart, we don't know anything and all those sorts of things. So when you first went into the acting space, was there a part of you that wished you could be heard? And actually that's now manifested itself into a point now where you've gone full circle and you're the listener, if that makes sense.
That's a really profound question. Was there a part of me that didn't feel heard? I mean, I'm going to have to say yes, I'm sure. And that must be the case for so many of us, right? I don't think I'll be alone in saying yes to that. And maybe that informs why I wasn't a particularly good listener before, because I think not being listened to is likely to generate the impulse in people to say, hey, look at me, listen to me, I've got something important to say, and express that in, just a myriad different ways, from something as trivial as being a bit of an interrupter of other people when they're talking, to thinking, I have got to be on stage, and hundreds of people have to be sitting in silence in the dark, having paid 50 or 60 quid to listen to me. That's how much I need to be listened to. Now, I'm not suggesting that that necessarily describes me, but I think there's probably a little kernel of truth in that for a lot of actors. I mean, you've really got me thinking now. What is the connection between perhaps feeling not heard and then finding you have some real connection and interest in a process like coaching? I need to think about that some more. I'm not going to waste too much of your listeners' time thinking about that in real time, but it's a fascinating question. Yeah.
Shall we track back a little bit then? So let's talk about this acting space, because, you know, I had an actress on the last season, and she said, you know, from the word go, it's what I wanted to do. At the age of 5, I'd already started organising productions in my head, even if it was just for my brother and the rest of the house. So let's delve into that a little bit. Where did this journey start for you, and what were some of the core experiences or moments that have kind of funneled you into the start of what's become like a lifelong journey for you?
Well, actually, oh my God, I'm having a light bulb moment, which means you're a good coach, Kevin. I listened to that podcast you mentioned, and it was wonderful. But that wasn't the case for me. That wasn't the case for me at all, actually. I think I found my primary school level of schooling, childhood, very difficult. I wasn't academic. I wasn't particularly good at sport. I was good at running, but football, rugby, those sorts of things, no. I was very small and very thin. And there were subjects I was okay at, but I wasn't particularly academic. And the reason why I just sort of, the light bulb I'm having is that I think certainly the school I went to, I had no sense of being particularly listened to or valued. It was, I mean, in many respects, I was enormously privileged because I went to a boarding school. You know, I went to a private school. And I went there at the age of 7, so I was very young. And I think for some people, that's an amazing thing. It wasn't for me. I was wholly and totally ill-equipped to deal with the independence required to exist in a space like that, in a school like that, at that age. I didn't have the skills that you need. I think adults call it executive functioning, organizational skills, all that sort of stuff. Memory like a sieve. I couldn't do it. Lose my pen every day. I was in a constant state of kind of bewildered chaos. And I realized that, you know, it was pretty Spartan, this school. It was pretty Spartan, you know, early morning runs, corporal punishment, all of that sort of stuff. And I remember thinking very early on, gosh, I don't really fit in here. I'm not a SWAT. I'm not very good at academics. I'm certainly not good at pummeling the living daylights out of my pals on the rugby field. In fact, feels like it's probably me getting the pummeling. And then I turned a corner, and like it is for so many of us in life, it was because of a teacher, an amazing guy called Sheffield Exum. Get that for a name. And Sheffield Exum, he did exactly what you've just described. He noticed me. He listened to me. And God knows why, but he did. And he taught me English, and he also taught Latin. I mean, I was I was spectacularly fucking dreadful at Latin. I just couldn't get, I mean, it was meaningless. It was meaningless. I mean, I could have had, you know, a fish bubbling at me would have made as much sense. I mean, it was, I was close. And he recognized that. And he recognized that he didn't really matter. But I was good at English. And he was kind and generous and threw books at me to consume and read. And I hoovered my way through this rather quaint sounding junior library. It was a shelf, you know, with a sort of a collection of five or six shelves. And I read virtually every book on it in a year. And I remember towards the end of this year, I'm probably 8 or 9 years old by now. He comes up to me and he sort of rather sort of mysteriously comes up to me. It must have been the end of a lesson or something. And he says, "Now then, Alistair, how would you like to play a part in a play that requires the learning of 300 lines? And I thought, and here's ever the actor, I thought, that sounds like a lot of lines. That must be a bloody good part. So I was like, yep, I'm in. Whatever it is, I'm in. It turned out he was talking about the play, not the musical, but the straight play of Oliver Twist. And he got me to play Oliver. Now, I've no idea if I was any good in Oliver. I probably wasn't. I was probably absolute rubbish. But if nothing else, I was brilliantly well cast. Young, wide-eyed, rather clueless, and looking ever so slightly ill. And he was very good. He was a really, really good organizer of plays for young people, a director. I mean, he just somehow had that magic touch where you can bring the chaos of young people together to create a coherent and joyful experience, not just for us doing it, but for the people watching it as well. And that was it. Oliver Twist was my first, maybe I did some stuff before that, a nativity play, I don't know, I can't remember, nothing significant that sticks in my memory. And it had a very profound effect
on
me.
How old were you at that point? Just
I was 9. Yeah, 9. 8 or 9. And I remember being on stage and the quiet and the darkness of the audience and the attention. And I don't mean the attention necessarily just on me, but just their attention on whatever was going on in this story, and thinking, wow, I'm in this thing with a set and all these people. It's a big cast, Oliver. There was loads of people on stage. And all those people out there, those parents and teachers, all they are doing is watching this story, watching this thing. And we're inhabiting this little world and doing our thing. And you could hear a pin drop when we stopped talking. And I thought, right, that's it. This requires some further examination. I need to look into this a bit harder. I like this. And that was the beginning of my interest in acting.
So let's fast forward, because and in no way in a condescending way to your choices there, but if you ask a lot of 8 and 9 year olds what do you want to do, although in my generation it might have been, I want to be an astronaut, which terrifyingly is now actually not too far from a possibility for people if you earn enough money. But I think it's really interesting as you go through that maturing phase, certainly in the early teenage years, to go from that grasp of childhood ambition to perhaps that more well-trodden path of what comes next in that particular profession. So when did you get to the point where you went from, I'm really enjoying this, this is something I definitely want to pursue longer term, to actually, here are the steps that are now laid out in front of me beyond the realms of the boarding school? What was that kind of, or can you remember that kind of transition period? Because I think for a lot of people, that's the leap of faith. You know, school, in inverted commas, is a relatively safe environment, whereas actually to turn around and go, I am going to now commit to moving to here or taking up this course or following this profession. And actually there is a real kind of stake in the ground moment there. And can you remember what that was like for you?
Yeah, there were 2 points to me. Okay, so one of them was looking in the university handbook at school. This is much later on. and identifying that you could do drama at university and thinking, oh, that's interesting. And I don't think I thought about it professionally at this stage. And then by the time I can't really chart this course specifically, other than saying I did a whole bunch of plays at my next school, culminating being in part of a drama club that a bunch of us students, this is when I'm 17 by now, had created. And it sounds terribly naff, but we thought we were anarchists, Kevin. We called it the Underground Theatre Company. Bunch of posh twats, you know. The Underground Theatre Company. And we weren't part of the school's drama club because we thought that was a bit stuffy and dull. And we put on some plays. We did some Monty Python stuff. I mean, this tells you how old I am. I'm in my late 40s. And at that stage, by then, and we did a production of Undermilk Wood. And by then I was thinking, okay, this is me. I can't really envisage doing anything else now. But to be fair, my father had, by this point in life, for any of your listeners who have been to private school or thinking about or have paid for private school for their kids will know, it's a lot of money. And poor old chap had poured rather a lot of his own money into this endeavour by now. And the idea of his son drifting off from school to drama school didn't fill him with joy. Frankly, I don't blame him. He said he was very good, my dad. Sadly, he died many years ago, but he was very good. You know, I always detected an air of sort of weary acceptance with him. And he was like, okay, all right. Look, would you just go to university for me and do that? And then you can, you know, you can do what you want after that. And I thought that was a fair request, given, you know, given his input into all this. So I did, which probably wasn't the best decision for me. I won't go into too many details into that, but I wasn't particularly happy at university for all sorts of reasons. I think I chose the wrong place. There were some good times there, but my overall summary of it was that it perhaps wasn't the best choice I've made in my life. However, it did give me an opportunity to do some more acting. And by the time I finished at university, I knew without a shadow of doubt what I needed to do. And really, I think part of the problem for me at university was within 3 weeks of being there, I thought, fuck it, I should have gone to drama school. But back in those days, of course, you didn't pay the price of a small house to go to university. House is a bit more than that now, but you know, it wasn't such a huge financial thing. I mean, you know, you paid your university fees, but they were a few thousand pounds. You could go to drama school afterwards, and I did. So I left university and I auditioned for a bunch of drama schools. And sure enough, I got into one of them and I went off and I did 2 years at drama school. So not the three years is the classic, but I did 2 years before I then graduated from there.
I find it fascinating because I go back about five seasons. I've lost all perspective of time, but we had somebody on from a dance school who'd gone to Trinity in London. And I was fortunate enough, they kind of connected me up with the dance network in the UK. And I went along to one of their performance centres face to face with actually a swimming coach. We were basically just being nosy and it had all been sorted out. So we went off to Ipswich and walked into this dance centre, and there was kids from the age of, you know, 7 or 8 there through to, you know, college age students studying the performing arts space. So we got taken into tap classes or every single form of, I guess, creative art in one building. It was incredible. Mm-hmm. And I came away from it mind blown by how much of a shift, if you like, that people immerse themselves in the doing of something. And I guess what I mean by that is when you go to, you talked about the old drama school being a little bit stuffy and university not potentially being the right place. I can tell you there's a hell of a lot of coaches out there that on day one sitting in a classroom looking at a coaching book sit there and go, this isn't coaching. This isn't what I signed up for. I want to be doing. I want to be out there and involved in stuff. So when you went into that drama school in that first 3 weeks of drama school, was it the complete opposite to that first 3 weeks at university where you felt like you were home almost in the right place?
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. Home. I was like, okay, this is my purpose. This is what I should have been doing. The other stuff, some of it was great. I've learned a lot, but this was like hooking up two train carriages. It just fitted and it was awesome and I loved it. And I had 2 years of it. I mean, what a privilege. 2 years in this place just to play and have fun and make great friends and, you know, do all of that. And to indulge oneself, actually, to really, yeah, to indulge yourself in, well, quite a lot of our craft that perhaps one doesn't get the opportunity to do quite so much once you go into the business. So it was wonderful and a huge privilege.
I'm curious then to what came next, because one of the things I've always not struggled with personally, but I think a lot of athletes experience it when they do the doing, if you like, and then they go into either the business or the more career-based side of it. So you get a lot of former athletes going to coaching and managing and stuff like that. So when you stepped away from your play area, if you like, and went into the wide working world, what was that transition like? Because I think I think we spoke before starting recording about the, you know, the 5-minute soundbite interviews of these Oscar winning actors and they go boom, ba boom, ba boom. And I won an Oscar and you go, oh, it's fantastic. I'll do that. So let's talk reality and the, I guess, the pragmaticness that we spoke about earlier of actually what was that real experience like going from I'm in the wrong place, I'm now in the right place, I've played for 2 years and now I've got to go and make it work in the wider world. What was that like?
Well, it was a mixture of so many things. I had a really wonderful experience in my second year at drama school where I did a production of a Chekhov play called The Seagull. And I played a part in it and it just really sat for me. And it was when I really remember this as the moment at drama school where I thought, for the first time, I thought, I don't just really enjoy this and love it. I think I can actually do this quite well. You know, everybody will get that experience, but that was my experience. And it was directed by a guy called Tom Hunsinger. And he's a brilliant guy. He is head of text and performance these days at RADA. I wasn't at RADA. I was at a drama school called Webber Douglas. It was a really good drama school. It was, you know, one of the top ones at the time. Sadly, it no longer exists. But Tom was teaching there at the time. And he saw me in The Seagull. And we worked together on another production there later. Must have been 2 or 3 weeks after I left drama school. And it was a tricky leaving. He called me up and he said, oh, hi, Alistair, I'm making a film and I wondered if you wanted to audition for it. I thought, yes. You're too damn right I do. So, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, sounds interesting, Tom. Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah, I'd like that. I'm thinking, thank fuck, thank God. And I go and meet him and his co-director. In Soho, and I sit down and I audition for this movie. It's only a little part, but it's a fabulous film. God, it's a good film. It's called Lawless Heart. Bill Nighy, Tom Hollander, Suki Smith. I mean, it's just packed with wonderful actors. British independent feature film. Dougie Henshaw, people like that. And I audition for it, this little part, and I get it. And it's wonderful. And I think, oh, right, well, it's a piece of cake. This is a piece of cake. I've got myself a little part in a movie. You know, this guy worked with a drama school. He's just contacted me and given me some work. Come on, business. And I go off to the Isle of Man where they're shooting the film and I do my little bit of filming. And of course, I'm only playing a little part, so I'm only there for a few days. And I don't know how much you know about filming, but filming, it for a jobbing actor like myself, my experience of filming pretty much everything I've ever done is I appear somewhere for a day or maybe a few days or maybe occasionally a little bit longer and then you go away. So what you don't do is come into a unit, create relationships and become part of a family over like a month or 2 months or more. And of course, this was the case with this job. I got there. I thought, oh, it's amazing. Oh, I'm going to have dinner here. And I had dinner with all these people, these actors I'd admired all my life. And there's Bill Nighy and all this lot, you know, buying dinner. And it's wow. And then shoo, back home. And the phone's not ringing. And you think, oh, that's interesting. I've just literally stuck my head into a parallel universe. And I rather like that parallel universe. And then it's like the tunnel. I'm sticking my head out of a train carriage and the tunnel's coming and I have to pull my head back in. And the phone didn't ring for a long time. And in that long time, I learned what it was for most drama school graduates and most young jobbing actors. And this will not be the first time you've heard this. It's bloody tough and it tests you. It tests how much you want it. It tests how creative you're going to be about making it work. It tests how hard you're going to work to find the money to exist whilst you're trying to make it work. It tests all sorts of things. And it took a while for me to be able to stick my head out of that train again and take another look into that parallel universe. But it did happen, but it took some time. And during that time, I started to think, right, okay, if I'm in this for the long game, and I think I am, I'm 26, because of course I've been to university, so I'm not a young drama school grad. I'm 24 when I come out, 25. I'm 26 by now. I'm thinking, if I'm in this for the long game, obviously I'm going to need to find some other stuff to do. Or first of all, I'm going to go off my mash. And secondly, I'm going to die of penury. So I start thinking, it's going to have to be something that in some way speaks to me in the way that acting does. And before, up until now, I've been being a waiter. I've been doing all the stuff that actors do. And I'm temping from time to time and various different things. And I meet a guy, an amazing guy called AV. I went to a workshop one Sunday afternoon in Camden, and it was being held by this guy called Bruce Wall. And he had this operation, this outfit called the London Shakespeare Workout. Funny sounding thing. And you go along to these workshops, and Bruce is an eccentric. He won't mind me saying that. He is a true eccentric. He has an American accent, and it's, hey, hey, Al, how are you? Okay, okay, let's do some Shakespeare. Okay, let's improvise. You're Hamlet in the middle of the desert. It's 500 years ago. Speak in iambic pentameter. Go. And you're like, holy fuck, how am I going to do that? And you do these mad workshops where you're trying to improvise and use Shakespearean language and all this stuff. And it sounds highbrow, but it isn't. It taps into some of the core sort of techniques and skills that actors need around improvisation. Anyway, what Bruce Wall did was he took this organization into prisons and did workshops with prisoners using Shakespeare. And they were kind of amazing. They were really wonderful. And I did loads of them in this year and a half kind of dead zone. Where I was at, I'd looked into the parallel universe and come back into the world of an unemployed jobbing actor. And it was amazing. And I met a guy called AV, who at the time was a serving prisoner. He was young, he was in his 20s, he was my age. And he came out of prison, and his partner worked for an organization called Training for Life. This was what was then called a training provider. At the time, these were kind of like a new labor initiative. So they provided training for, I think, what you probably call nowadays NEETs. So not employed or whatever NEET stands for, I can't remember. And Sarah, AV's partner, took me on at Training for Life as part of a training team, delivering training to people. And these were for people who wanted to get back into employment. And it was sort of soft skill training, you know, a bit of communication skills stuff and other things that help people get back into a place where they're ready for the to go into the jobs market. And I really enjoyed it. It was amazing. Working with people who were fascinating and brilliant, but for all sorts of reasons, had been dealt some rotten hands in life. And delivering these training sessions, and it was wonderful. And that catalyzed my interest in communication and training, which is kind of where a lot of my life is spent today. But of course, I'm on this train as an actor, and it's not long before the window opens. Sorry, this is a really mixed metaphor that's about to crash into a wall. Of course, the phone is ringing every now and again with an audition. And I have this friend, an actor friend, who I'd met, the only actor I knew before I became an actor. I knew nothing about the world of acting. I was pig ignorant. But I knew this one actor, a guy called Robert Hands. And he'd been introduced to me by a family friend years before. He'd helped me audition to get into drama school. He was like a mentor. And he rings me up one day and he says, look, I'm working with this company and I think they want to take somebody on. I think you'd be great. And I say, OK, fine, great, fantastic. I mean, conversations like that happen for actors all the time. So, you know, you don't add too much weight to it. But it was working for a theatre company called Propeller, the artistic director of which was Ed Hall. And for any actors who are listening of over the age of 30, they will have heard of Propeller. It was everything I wanted to do, everything. It was the Shakespeare company to work for at the time. And I met Ed Hall, and they were just about to bring one of their shows into the West End. And I went to the National Theatre where he was directing a show at the time, and I met him. And he gave me a job. He said, right, I'm gonna give you a job. You're going to come into this company, and it's Midsummer Night's Dream, and you're going to understudy half the company, and I'm going to hire somebody else to understudy the other half. And when you do that well, I will then bring you into this company. And that was like, oh my God, wow, okay. And so I had to learn and rehearse half of the parts in A Midsummer Night's Dream in a febrile June and July. This is back in 2003, so a long time ago. It turned out that my friend Robert Hands was playing, now I should say at this stage, that it was an all-male Shakespeare company. Now, in 2022, that is a somewhat old-fashioned idea. But in 2003, Propeller was just at the forefront of really creative ensemble theatre, but all the actors were on stage all the time. They all played the music live. It was anarchic, it was irreverent, and the audiences went crackers for it. They loved it, absolutely loved it, and particularly young people. Young people were just obsessed. And I had seen some of their work when I'd been at drama school, and I knew I wanted to work for this company, but you know. So I spend the summer rehearsing in, and I'm an understudy, and he gets me, you know, I'm in part of the show, I'm in the ensemble, but I'm not really doing anything. And then this friend of mine, Robert Hands, is playing the part of Helena. Now, anybody who knows the play knows that Helena is the part in the play. It's a fabulous part for a woman. It's amazing. And we had the opportunity to play it because it was an all-male company. He announces he's got another job towards the end of the year. And if the show is extended, which it looks like it might be, he can't do it. And they say, right, it's you. You've covered this part, you've understudied it. When Robert Hands goes, you're in. And sure enough, I was. And later that year, I find myself on the first night I'm doing it, on stage at what was then the Comedy Theatre, now the Harold Pinter, in front of a packed West End audience, playing one of the best parts in Shakespeare. And it was an incredible trajectory from having been, unemployed, and thinking, what the fuck is going on? How am I gonna, you know, with my acting? But I'm doing this training stuff with Training for Life, and I'm liking that, but it's not quite, you know, I'd love to do them both if I could. And there I am doing this thing. And that marked a bit of a gear shift for me for a few years. And it was a really wonderful time.
So when did that step come into the space of voice acting? Because especially being a podcaster and spending a little bit more time in the world of audio, if you like, than perhaps I would have 5 years ago, I've certainly become much more appreciative of the nuances and the challenges and how hard work it is, but also the range of things that we don't even think about in our lives that voice actors do. So what was that? This obviously probably wasn't saying that was on your radar back when you were 9 years old, but actually, when did that first emerge? And again, what's that kind of journey been like?
Yeah, that's really interesting. I loved reading out loud when I was young. And it's always been a great pleasure to me. Actually, my voiceover career didn't really take off until quite far into my acting career. Like so many of the different elements of our profession, when you have a sector that is so unbelievably overcrowded with talent, because not only are there so many people and supply so massively outstrips demand, there's fucking loads of talent, so many good people, that it's very hard to break into any of these areas. My attention had been almost exclusively on theatre, because I'd gone on this kind of roller coaster of several years, or many years, in fact, with this company, Propeller, working all over the world. And it was incredible. I was doing a show in the West End. I was doing a play called War Horse that you've probably heard of in 2015. And I had a voiceover reel, and I'd done a little bit of voiceover work, but nothing really of any real importance. And like is often the case in our business, one of the people in the cast had a voiceover agent, a really wonderful voiceover agent, and she came to see the show, and I persuaded her to take me on. Sarah is her name, and she's magnificent at a voiceover agency called AdVoice. And she took me on, and she helped me put together a new what they call a reel, which is a digital recording of your different types of voice work that you can do. And that allowed me to then be doing radio commercials, voiceover work, computer game voiceovers, you know, that kind of stuff. So that happened relatively late on for me. But what I love about voiceover work, well, I love so many things about it. It, for a start, on the whole, you tend not to audition. People listen to your reel and they go, I want you, I don't want you, I might, whatever. So you forgo that part of it, which is really a bit of a relief, because the audition process is enjoyable in some respects, but in some respects it's maddening, because on the whole, actors tend to get, unless you get the job, there's no feedback, there's no, there's nothing, you know. So I like that. I love the discipline of being in a studio and having a small amount of dialogue and having to make that land according to what the client or the director wants. And there's a real intimacy between you and the director or the producer and the engineer because of the setup, a little bit like there is with a podcast. And you can work in a very precise and detailed way. And I love that. And you're treated respectfully. Sadly, that's not always the case in other parts of the industry, but you're treated respectfully, and this matters, you're paid well. So for all those reasons, I rather like doing voiceovers.
So what was, and I'm sure there's been plenty of examples, but if we take from the acting journey, that incredibly quick rise, if you can call it a quick rise, but an incredible moment of going from a potential meeting that turned into an understudy role and turned into being on center stage. Have you had any moments where you look back across your voiceover work and have gone, wow, that was really cool? Or, and I know this is weird for actors, musicians and anyone else, but have you heard your work when you've been out and go, oh yeah, that's me? Like, have you had moments like that where you take in the gravity of what you've done? Because I think it's very easy, and I say this more with my athlete head on. I work a lot with athletes, and they, because they're surrounded by other athletes doing similar things, they kind of go, oh yeah, no, it's cool. Like, you know, I just go to the Olympics. And you're like, anyone else, that blows their mind. So have you had any of those kind of pinch yourself moments on the voice acting side of things?
Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, I've heard myself on the radio, but it's always been in the car for some reason, but maybe that's because that's where I listen to the radio actually. But it's immediately brought down to earth by my daughter either immediately turning the radio onto a different station or going, oh God, it's you. So any sense of celebration is immediately dampened by my daughter going, oh God, it's you. You just sound weird. What? Why were you advertising that? Oh, no, I'm not listening to that. I'm not listening to it. So yes and no. The radio commercial work I've done. How? What's the best way to put this? I really value that work in all sorts of ways. And I've just mentioned some of the ways just now. But creatively and artistically, it's a finite game. So no, I wouldn't say I've been blown away by my own brilliance on radio commercials. other voiceover. Well, actually, funnily enough, I did something recently that I haven't done before. And I really enjoyed it. I did some dubbing on a foreign language film. Now, I was rather in the dark ages about dubbing because my relationship to dubbing was a bit of a joke and slightly embarrassing. And someone spoke, and then a few seconds later, they
watched the Bruce Lee. I'm thinking I've one experience of dubbing, and it's a Bruce Lee film. And I remember watching it, going, surely. Surely there's a better way of doing it than that.
Exactly, which is why most of us, I think, I don't want to make assumptions, but perhaps would have chosen subtitles over a dub. There has been a bit of a revolution in dubbing, and very clever people have spent time bringing their attention to how it can be made much, much better and more specific. And the quality of dubbing on films now is very, very high. I mean, it isn't, it's never going to be perfection because the vowels and syllables are going to be in different places and what have you. The vowels and consonants are going to be in different places and what have you, depending on the language. But it is transformed from the wacky sort of lip-moving madness sound a few seconds later of, yeah, Bruce Lee. Or do you remember, you're too young. There's a show when I was young called Monkey Magic. A Chinese show, again, martial arts with dubbing. I mean, it was just comic genius in its own right. So I recently did some dubbing for an amazing German show called The Empress. It's on Netflix at the moment. Check it out. And I guess there's probably a subtitled version, but there is also a dubbed version. And what I learned going into the studio to do that dubbing and watching what had been dubbed already was that there's a whole new world now, and the benchmark has been raised very, very, very high in dubbing. And it's really impressive. It's really impressive. And it was, I enjoyed it because as an actor, it was very demanding and I had to learn very quickly. But it's really rewarding because when you just about match the movement of the actor on the screens, mouth with your words, it's a very satisfying thing. Not to mention that you can characterize your voice you make an intuitive decision about how to characterize your voice based on what you're seeing in front of you. And I very quickly made the choice, I don't want to hear what they sound like because they're going to blow my mind. Let me take a punt and you tell me whether you think we're in the right neck of the woods. And I think, as is often the case with actors, that the intuition is the way to go. So I loved it. Dubbing's great, and I'd love to do loads more of that. So it was a fantastic experience, but I hadn't done it before. In terms of, I mean, sorry, you're going to say something, Kevin?
No. I was going to pick up on one of those threads, but let's go with you while it's fresh in your mind.
I think in terms of going, oh, wow, I did that. I've had that in slightly different ways. I've had it a bit when I've done the bits of TV and film that I've done. Weirdly, and I think it's because the ubiquity of television commercials, when you're on a TV commercial, it's on so frequently that it becomes a bit weird. Because people are sort of messaging you every 5 minutes going, oh, I just saw your beer commercial. Oh my God, you were in a submarine. What's what? And it's a funny thing because, you know, you're not in Bridgerton or some other astonishing piece of, you know, dramatic brilliance. You're peddling some stuff on telly. And it's a curious thing. I'm not going to mention products because it wouldn't be appropriate, but there's a ubiquity to your image, but it's sort of married with something which is, you know, kind of prosaic, really, and quite down to earth. So it's a curious thing, and it's a lovely opportunity for actors to mock each other endlessly, but in commercials, because you're there all the time to be mocked, doing something that is quite mock worthy. But for me, it's theatre. If somebody comes up to me and says, I saw that production of Twelfth Night that Propeller did at the Old Vic in 2007, it just makes my heart leap. Because one of the, its greatest asset and its abiding sadness, like life itself, is that theatre is there and then it's gone. And you do it and it's gone, it's dust. And the only people that know about it are the people that were there and watched it at the time. And you can't go back to it. It'll never be there again. They might do a production again, but it won't be the same. And it's dust in the wind. And so it's very special when people say, I saw that when I was at drama school, or I saw that when I was at school, and that production blew my mind and made me want to become an actor. And having been in a handful of shows where I've had myself and the people in those in that company have had dozens, hundreds of people say that, is the most wonderful thing. It's amazing.
There's a beautiful golden thread that I'm backtracking through a lot of my interviews, and I interviewed an Olympic medalist from the Beijing Olympics. So where are we now? 14, 15 years ago. And she didn't medal at the London Olympics. She had, I think it was 0.something of a second over a 2-hour race. And she said at the time it was a bitter disappointment at a home Olympic Games in London to have not medalled. And she's a parent now. And I interviewed her maybe 18 months ago. And she said, I have people come up to me and say, I was on the riverbank in London in 2012 and cheering for you and watching what you did changed my life, because I've actually now taken up open water swimming. I make sure my kids have learned it and all of those sorts of things. And I think it's the wider ripple effects that you can never anticipate, because you can't plan when people are going to come and say those things to you, and you can't customize the personal impact that it's going to have, because like every piece of art, the beauty is in the eye of the beholder. So that every person sitting in that theater will have a different experience. And I think that's one of the really special things about doing something that you're so passionate about, is when you get that feedback, it doesn't hit you there, it hits you in here. And I think that's something that I really love the point about, you know, your daughter turning off the radio and all those sorts of things. And you have those beautiful moments where actually you're brought crashing back down to earth, but in a really kind of heartwarming way. I haven't actually had him on the podcast yet, but one of my friends actually medaled at the London Olympics. And he said, I was like, obviously buzzing. It was amazing. And he said, I traveled back down to where I was living at the time, down West Country. And I was like, my housemates are going to have done this massive party. And he said, he'd walked up the drive and all the lights are off. And he's like, they're all waiting in the dark. It's going to be amazing. And he said, I opened the door and my housemate was watching whatever it was in his pants, eating a tube of Pringles. And he looked over and he went, all right. And I'll never forget that. But actually, it's I know they're in different spheres, but I can fully appreciate like having nieces and nephews like doing things that you're really proud of, and then kids just going, pipe down, I don't want to hear it. It's it's wonderful.
It's really good, and I think theatre is the ultimate. In a way, is in our industry. I mean, that's wonderful about the. About being at the Olympics. I love that so much. But I think for theatre is the ultimate expression of that in our business, because, you know, you can perform to a full house, get a standing ovation, and have the most extraordinary response to a show in the West End, New York, wherever you are. And then a week later, you can be back home and worrying about how you're going to, you know, pay for your broken boiler or whatever. It's just, it's there and then it's gone. It's there and then it's gone. But yes, that feedback is very important, isn't it? I think for me, it feeds into one of the other parts of my purpose, which is bringing this stuff to young people, and particularly Shakespeare, because I did so much work in my earlier career with this company doing Shakespeare plays, and it's sort of what led me to the work I do at the Globe now. And for me, I think some of the most amazing and rewarding experiences I've had have been performing Shakespeare or delivering workshops, but performing as well to young people and sparking a curiosity or even a passion in young people in that work. That's just the most valuable thing, like your friend who inspired people on the banks of the Thames.
So there's, go back maybe 4 or 5 seasons, I'd always ask the question of what will your message be to your childhood younger self? But I've changed that over the recent months, because I do genuinely believe that the path, you know, most trodden perhaps isn't your path, and actually giving advice to your younger self on what you could have done or should have done is almost irrelevant, because your path and all of those unusual and surprising twists and turns is what led you there. And you know, I had I think on the last season, or maybe a season before that, Charlie Borman, who went around the world with Ewan McGregor on motorbikes, and he effectively had an acting career that kind of went off the rails a little bit. And he said, if my acting career hadn't gone off the rails, probably wouldn't have ended up going around the world and having all those incredible experiences. So I'm going to change, I guess, the question to pull all of this together. For young people that are just getting started on their journey, what is your message to those people now? Because I think that's where we can pull down some wisdom, but actually apply it in a real world setting for the next generation.
Yeah, I've had a really good think about this. I mean, for myself over the years, obviously. And I feel a tiny bit conflicted at times, because I'm mindful of the fact that I'm a guy in my late 40s. And much as you like to think you've got your finger on the pulse, perhaps it's not quite as close to the pulse as we'd like to imagine. So, any suggestions or advice I give, I sprinkle with salt, because, you know, it might lose some potency as it goes down the generations. But I think the flexible mindset in our business is everything. I think and I don't want to sound sort of facile about that, and I can be specific about what I mean by that. But I think we have to recognize that, on the one hand, you must have goals and targets and dreams, and we have to throw ourselves into those. And yet, it's important that our flexible mindset is able to identify a range of goals and dreams. Looking back on my younger self. I'm going to sorry, I apologize. I'm conscious that I'm answering a question that you weren't going to pitch, but it's just part. It's just come into this answer. I didn't particularly have a flexible mindset 20 years ago when I left drama school and became an actor. And I think a flexible mindset is really important. I mean, to deal with rejection, obviously, to manage the whimsical nature of this business, but also to constantly be asking yourself, how can I bring these skills to other work that people are going to want and that's going to give me a sense of fulfillment and it's going to pay my bills? And I think actors frequently undervalue their soft skills. What actors can bring to lots of other work, I think, is really, really valuable. And the more training I do, the more contact I have with people in business, the more I realize that perhaps the greatest perennial challenge that people experience are failures in communication. I read some bonkers stat the other day that of all the startups that go, most of them fail, and most of them fail because relationships fail and communication fails, which is kind of, I thought that was quite striking. Not because the product's shit or the service is no good, but just because the dynamics of the relationships within that unit just don't work. And that's about communication. So I think actors have a lot of those skill sets at their disposal because we're trained in storytelling, in communicating. And the flexible mindset will always find ways in which you can bring those to other walks of life. That could be teaching, it could be working in some respect in the care sector, it could be doing, I mean, you know, training, I don't know. There are so many different ways in which you can apply that. So I think a flexible mindset's really important. Tolerance, goodwill, basic accounting, so boring, but you know. I was rotten with numbers and just, you know, I used to do my accounts when I first left drama school. I can't believe I actually did it myself. I mean, it was just a miracle I wasn't sent to prison because the mistakes I must have made, I mean, just the trash that I must have submitted as my accounts. I mean, not because I was being consciously dishonest, just because I was completely fucking incompetent. But a basic sense of accounting and management of one's finances when you're self-employed. And I think we human beings, actors, whatever, we're so much more than our job. And the rejection is so often so little to do with actually how good you are at your work. It's so much more arbitrary than that. And just trying to keep that in mind. My experience with rejection over the years is that it reminds me of grief on a kind of microscopic level. And I now know with rejection for a job that I want that I will experience a little bit of grief. And I can write it out in a day or two now. And just to embrace that and go, this is what it is. I know what it is and it will pass and then I'll move on. There are probably other things, but they don't come to the front of my mind right now, Kev. But those are the most immediate ones.
I think... And to share with the listeners, one of the things I'm saying to our guests before we start recording is around the what are we actually looking for out of our conversation? What is the, if you like, our goal? And what would be the things that would make it an enjoyable experience for the guests? And the words that I've listened to before you started and noted down is around projecting an honest insight as to what your experience has been, understanding to great depth what your purpose is and how that's evolved and changed. But to be honest, just that great level of honesty and authenticity about your journey, but also the sectors, not just sector, but sectors that you've worked across. And I think we've ticked all of those boxes. And I think there are people who will come off the back of this interview and go, okay, maybe I have got things that I can transfer into other areas. Maybe there are things that I'm not utilizing that perhaps if I just open my mind a bit more, I could try out. And if it doesn't work, embracing that failure of it's a learning opportunity, it will pass and I will move on to the next thing, I think is a really nice way to pull all of that together. So Al, I just want to say a huge thank you, because I know we've waited a while to get this one recorded. I knew this was going to be a fantastic interview because, you know, I can tell about your passion and your purpose in what you do. And I'm just so glad that's come across in our conversation today. So just a huge thank you.
Kevin, thank you. What an unusual privilege it is to chat about these things. The self-reflection is really interesting. And I'd like to thank you for a light bulb moment around that thing that cropped up right at the beginning about being listened to, which is very interesting. So thank you. It's been fantastic. And I've really enjoyed talking to you. And yes, I hope sifting through all of that, there are one or two little nuggets that might be useful.
A huge thank you for joining us today. You can connect with today's guest and all our Road Monkey podcast socials through the links below this episode. If you're involved in a business, we would also love for you to check out our collaboration with Richard Cheatham MBE, our episode 44 guest, the link to which is also in the show notes. Finally, just a quick reminder to subscribe to the podcast, however you're joining us today, and please do pass this episode on to at least one person you think would take inspiration from it. Have a great week, and thanks again for being part of the Road Monkey podcast community.